Hi, I'm Trevor Elio.
And I'm Julie Stern, and this is Conceptually Speaking, the show where we interview experts to uncover the concepts and patterns that help us organize our world.
From farming to fashion, we can understand any field through acquiring, connecting, and transferring conceptual relationships. We hope this podcast will inspire teachers and students to design creative solutions to complex problems and accelerate innovation in today's schools. If you're interested in our work, you can find out more at edtosavetheworld.com.
Today's episode of Conceptually Speaking features educator, author, consultant, maker, and all-around lover of learning, Dan Ryder. As you can tell by his bio, Dan is a bit of a polymath. He writes and presents about creativity, design thinking, makerspaces, comic books, and, as is the focus tonight, improv. It's those generalist tendencies that make him such a compelling guest and intuitive educator. Despite these far-flung interests, his concepts of focus on the episode, acceptance, communication, and trust, lie at the heart of all he does. That's because, like us, Dan understands the value of anchoring learning with powerful concepts and frames.
And I think it would really help us all if we started looking at mindfulness, improviser's mindset, you pick the frameworks that help you, start looking at them less as another thing that you're doing and start looking at them as the architecture. Build your learning experiences around them with those in the center, right? Like, let them truly be frames. I mean, that's the whole point of a frame. It's like it has structure to it, right? It gives you a place to set things and build off of, right?
What I love about this episode and speaking with Dan in general is the energy and insight he brings to the table. Chats with him have the same exploratory and extemporaneous energy as an improv set. High tempo though it may be, there's always a pleasant timbre that makes conversation feel easy. Dan has a way of talking to you like an old friend, whether you've known him for years or just met. It was the first thing I noticed about him when we met 3 years ago, and it holds true today. You're in for a great episode. Enjoy. Our guest this week is Dan Ryder, a learning facilitator at Overman Academy in Skowhegan, Maine, an educational consultant and author. Great to have you, Dan.
Hey, it's great to be here, Trevor. Thank you. Thank you, Julie, for having me.
For sure. We've been wanting to have you on the show when I say months, that's significant because that's how long the podcast has been going.
Well, that's pretty cool.
So really from the start, we wanted to have you on. So super excited to have you joining us today.
Well, thanks. That just lets me know that you did not have high expectations for your podcast. you kept the bar right where it should be to
start with. Untrue. I'm sure many of our listeners would already disagree. If you haven't heard of Dan Ryder, you will certainly by the end of this episode. But we're super excited to have you. We've collaborated before, and we, with your permission, have added one of your teaching strategies to our new book that's coming out in Woo-hoo! March. So we're really excited to have you on the show and to chat with us. So what are you going to chat with us about? I mean, this is a guy who's into maker spaces, design thinking, of course, so many different ideas. But do you want to tell our listeners, what are you going to chat with us about today?
Well, there's so much going on in the world right now, and I'm in a personal time of transition. So we're in the time of COVID, and I'm in a time of great professional transition after quite a spring and summer of professional Sturm and Drang. So that got me thinking about what are some concepts that kind of sit underneath everything that I do, like what's in the underpinnings, right? If you peel back the layers like an episode of Fixer Upper,
right?
Or
wallpaper back there,
right or Flip This House, you're like, oh, what's under here? Oh gross. Let's put that back. For me, I have been performing and directing improv comedy for 20 years now. Let's see, 2000. Yeah, about 20 years. And I love it. It's a passion of mine. It's something that kind of reaches back to my childhood and my love of comedy and growing up loving Saturday Night Live and goofy comics, but really sketch comedy. I started directing a comedy group in the high school where I used to work. Like my second year of teaching. And the Curtain Raisers became a sketch comedy group, then became an improv group, and then became this multimedia group. And then we just did all this great stuff. But we really took root as an improv team. And it wasn't just about the comedy. And that's not why I loved improv. It was because it gave those learners an opportunity to learn a skill that they could start applying everywhere. And I know we say that about sport, and we say that about music, and we say that about theater and debate. You know, why do we do extracurriculars? Well, it gives you tangible skills you can use everywhere. But it's rare that you end up learning a skill that you literally can use every moment of every day, but you're just learning it in the service of entertainment. Right, to tell story. So once I had started directing and I'd started performing more myself, and I needed to find a way to explain improv to people. I wanted to start offering workshops, but I didn't feel like I had anything to say that my improv teachers at Improv Boston, which is where I learned my craft, like that I didn't learn from Will Loera there or Elise there, or Don, or any of the people who I took classes with there. I was like, what do I have to say? I've got nothing. But what I realized was, I constantly like to take large concepts, big ideas, and try to distill them down into their core, right? Almost like what this whole podcast is.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah? You guys don't like doing that at all, right? Right. But we take this big, massive world of improv, and when we distilled it down, what I realized is that all of improvisation comes down to three core principles: acceptance, communication, and trust. In order to perform as an improviser, you have to learn acceptance. You have to take what you're given by your fellow actor and run with it. And truly run with it. Not like, oh, that's nice that you said a thing. Now I'm going to ignore that.
Right.
I'm going to ignore it.
Yeah.
You know, hey, Uncle Bunny. No, I'm Uncle Vanya. Wait a minute. No, that's negating. So learning to build with what you have, that's acceptance. And focusing on what you have and not stressing about what you don't. Communication. You're like, it's an obvious one in many ways, but at the heart of that is to remember that 90% of communicating is listening, and listening with our whole selves, not just our ears, but with our eyes, our bodies, being fully present in this place of reception, right? And then the last one, and this is the hardest one. Oh, I should say, and for communication on stage, it seems obvious, but that's the only way you know what your partners are doing. It's the only way you know what's working for the audience and what isn't. And it's also, you know, when you get into that place, you learn how to read an audience. You learn to read the difference between a bored audience and a thoughtful audience. And that's a thing that you only learn by listening. And because silences sound different. It's weird, but it's true. It's so true. A small laugh of a thoughtful audience has a completely different energy from a big laugh of a not caring audience, you know, of it just like, I just want funny, stupid things. I'm drunk. You know, like you can tell the difference. So there's those two things. And both of those lead you to developing trust. And it's trusting your fellow scene partner, but it's also trusting yourself. It's trusting your decisions. It's having enough confidence and having enough strength of character, of knowledge, of self to go into a situation and let someone else take the lead. And it's having the wherewithal to know, this is the moment when I step back and I trust that my scene partners are going to do the work. And now they're relying on me. So I better step in and I better trust that the thing I say is going to be okay. Right. So you have to do all that in order to be a good improviser. And the content of what you say in improv, well, that comes from practice experience, your attitude, your sense of humor and all that. But in terms of being able to do the craft and do the work of improvisation, you really just have to focus on those three things. And the rest of it will all come along, the storytelling, the character work, all that. That's like fluff. Those three things, you tell me one place where you don't need those three skills functioning at peak, right? So that, when I discovered that, I realized that that was what all of my work, whether it's the book I wrote with Amy Burball, Intention, plug, plug, Critical Creativity in the Classroom, plug, plug, 40 plus activities for creative expression in any classroom, plug, plug. Not that I'm plugging that, because why would I do that? I mean, that would be crass and unnecessary. But when we were putting it together, it couldn't have happened if I didn't have that improviser's mindset. Couldn't have adopted design thinking. Couldn't have found ways into that. Couldn't have started my Success and Innovation Center. I shouldn't say our Success and Innovation Center. Couldn't have made the pivot to where I am today.
I love that. Yeah, I love you. Just the idea of innovator's mindset. I remember, you know, something we talk about a lot as a team, because we all did a call with you a few months ago, and you were talking about sort of the struggle of treating design thinking as this procedural step by step, almost like a recipe, and that it's like an ethos. It's a way of thinking. It's a way of sort of approaching a situation. And so it makes sense that you would bring another sort of very interesting thing that I'm sure my team and I are going to be talking a lot about like innovate, you know, improvisers. I'm like, how do I even say this? Improvisers mindset. I love it. We have, you know, one of my original co-authors and teammates, Juliette Monkard, did improv as well. And she just talks so much about how it's impacted her life and impacted her work as a teacher and impacted her work as a leader. She's currently a school principal now, but she always taught me, you know, and I'm still to this day very conscious of yes, but versus yes.
Yes, but get that out.
Get there. Yeah, throw it away. And just, you know, the idea that whatever your scene partner says, you just go with it. Yes, and
right,
just builds on it and just keep going. I love that. It's such a tiny thing, but I think it makes a big difference in working with others for sure.
Well, it just, you know, the thing about yes and versus yet, but for me is when someone explained to me, and this was a therapist who explained it to me, that the yes, but, amazing therapist, by the way, Dawn Jepson, highly recommend her. She retired, so you can't use her, but whatever. She's awesome. Amazing hypnotherapist. And she taught me that, like, one of the first things, because she was teaching me hypnosis as well, and the art and craft of self-hypnosis for therapeutic purposes. And she was explaining how our brains aren't conditioned to accept negatives. We only accept positives. And that doesn't mean we only accept rosy, happy things. It means we don't accept the idea of no. We don't accept don't think about chocolate chip cookies.
Right. So tell me about it, because I have a 4 and 6 year old. I very much understand.
Right. They don't know.
They do not accept no. I mean, that's such a great parenting pivot too, because when we stood, Trevor's on his way here, and so this is relevant. But instead of telling your kid no, figure out how to say something like, well, maybe tomorrow, or how about we do this instead? Or just, you know, it's like, instead of the word no coming out of your mouth, you can prevent a lot of toddler tantrums. And I think it's true.
It's totally true for adults. It's totally true. And that, you know, and the piece is, because we aren't conditioned for it, we constantly speak in a way that does two things. It negates what our partner, our communication partner, is saying, because when we say but, we're really saying not. We're really saying no,
right,
to whatever they put on the table. Well, that's all fine and good, but this other thing I have to say is
it's
more
true,
important.
It's true.
Right? So, like, So there's that. And on top of that, you're trying to get your brain to accept something it's not going to, because you've established it as a negative. So you've already made it harder for yourself. You've made it harder to remember. You've made it harder to dialogue. You've negated what someone else has put on the table, when most of the time you didn't even mean but. Meant and. These two things can both exist. I just want to make the point that your point is valid and I have a valid one as well. Mm-hmm. We don't say that. We go, that's true, but no. And I still do it all the time. Kids hear me do it all the time. I go, not but. And I catch myself.
That was kind of my next question was how do you bring this mindset into your work with students? You work primarily with secondary students, correct?
Right. And I've just embarked in my new position at Overman Academy. I now also work with middle schoolers, middle level, and it's amazing. But it's the first time in my career. I spent 22 years working with 9 through 12, and now I'm working with 6 through 12. And
it's a whole other ball game.
But it's so different. It's a multi-level school, like they're all intersecting. You know, we got seniors working with 7th graders, and they're working side by side on the same things, on the same ideas.
Very cool.
And so it's really cool. It's really exciting, but it's also like, oh, this is totally different.
Yes, exactly.
This is not the same. Oh no.
It's like the energy level is as like a total flip flop.
Oh, it is. And it's cool. It's also a smaller school. So it works really well because it works well at the scale it's at. And I could see it not working at a larger scale. I could see it working really well other places, but like you can only have so many, like before you start not being able to build that community. But like you were saying, like, where do I work this in? A lot of it is admittedly just kind of like in the DNA of the rest of the work we do, right? Because I find that when working with adolescent learners, when you give them a cheesy acronym to learn, they're not always the biggest fan. like it screams to them, this is not authentic because I have been given so many acronyms in my day. And I think it all started with our generation, probably with DARE, where we were deconditioned to, or we were conditioned to like disregard acronyms because DARE was such a joke. I feel like whenever I try to do that with them and teach the ACT improviser's mindset, it doesn't work. But when I have these conversations like we're having now, where I sit with a small group and I say, look, guys, I'm looking for three things. I want you to learn how to accept. I want you to learn how to communicate. I want to let you learn how to trust. And if you can get those three things, then all the rest of the stuff is going to come together. I promise you. I promise. If we work on just those three things, and when I sit with you and I see you're like bashing your head against the wall, sometimes literally, I'm going to say, dude, this is a trust issue. Like, you don't trust yourself right now. And we've got to get you there. Or I go, hey, you know, my friend, like, you are not in a place of acceptance right now. You really want a totally different reality from the one that we're currently facing. And it just isn't there. Like, I adore you. I think the world of you. And reality's calling. And it's saying, you don't have the capacity to do this right now.
I love how that does. I feel like that does two things. First of all, it sort of situates students to be thinking about those three things at all times. And secondly, it gives you sort of a shared language and framework to have conversations about problem solving, where when you ask a student, you know, like, what's going on? What's wrong? And, you know, if you could think about the millions of things that are going through their pubescent minds, they could probably invent quite a few. But when they know that, okay, whatever is happening right now must be a breakdown of acceptance, communication, or trust, I think that allows them to conceptualize a little bit more quickly, more easily, ways that problems are breaking down or ways that they can improve a situation. And when they say acceptance, and if you've created a culture where your students are talking about acceptance all the time and they can have a conversation with their classmates, like, I think this is an acceptance issue.
And that other student's like, oh, okay, I know what acceptance is. We've talked about it so much. And I think that that is something that is missing many times when we're having a conversation. What the words that are coming out of our mouth or the words that our students are saying to each other, we have such different conceptions of what they mean. that it, because, you know, we're the way that we think about them is so different. But when you really anchor and organize, you know, whether it's an improv group or a classroom around understanding those things, I think it makes communication more possible because those understandings are shared and they're embodied.
Entirely. And it like, and we've been talking about like on the SEL side of things, right? But this stuff, like with all things, I'm always trying to find a way like, ooh, how can I take this little framework that I like and apply it to all the things, right? But like, imagine like talking about a piece of literature through this lens, like character analysis through the perspective of acceptance, communication, and trust. All right. Hey, let's deconstruct the plot of this novel. What's really happening in this, you know, thinking like Jason Reynolds, Long Way Down. Like, that would be such an interesting book to take apart from an improviser's mindset place, right? To do a reading of the protagonist and like what he's going through. Like where is he strong in trust? Where is he strong in communication? Where is he struggling in acceptance? Like, to what extent, you know, kind of do a strength analysis of him, or you know, I was trying to think of it like another good one, or like or any time at any point in history.
I was gonna say, yeah, politics for sure. Yeah.
Politics for sure. Mm-hmm. Like, this is like punching us in the face at the moment.
Yeah.
But even like go back into like, you could go back a little ways, you know, look at the politics of the 1950s, right? And you could do some interesting work with looking at the 1950s that we believe in from this popular culture perspective versus what was actually happening, and using this ACT like as your like your measurements. Oh, in this version of the 1950s that we have given to us by Grease and I Love Lucy reruns, right? And whatever other pop culture, Back to the Future, I'm forgetting like the most important depiction of the 1950s, right? If those are our lenses, right, that's what we're seeing. Well, where does our culture seem to be at with ACT then? Well, then let's look at it through the lens of McCarthyism, the Red Scare, you know, the men retaking their position in the workplace, post-World War II, like, and we take that and we look at that lens of the 50s and go, so what's going on? And like, oh,
right.
We've got two different depictions, but we just gave us a frame to look at it through that could also tell us a lot about where we're at right now.
Mm-hmm.
And where are we struggling?
It's definitely, I love that, the idea too, that you pointed out, Trevor, that you're given adolescents language and specific ideas to unpack some of the subconscious sort of mental, emotional state. It almost reminds me a little bit of Brené Brown, of just like underneath all this stuff is this, you know, feeling of vulnerability, or, you know, just allowing them to talk about those things of acceptance, communication, and trust, just to really access it right now. Like you said, a kid who's having a hard time, like, you're not trusting yourself. And so it's freeing to go sort of give them that vocabulary and give them those ideas to be able to make sense of whatever. I mean, adolescence is very difficult. It's difficult to go from being a child to being an adult. And so I can imagine they really appreciate being given those words to be able to describe what they're feeling, what they're experiencing.
Even if they don't always articulate.
Absolutely.
Related. It's a way of showing that appreciation. which is, hey, let's talk about this ACT. Shut up, man. You don't even. Like, wait, what are you saying? I don't even know. You don't even know. You don't even know the school. I hate this school so much. You don't even get it. You don't, if you don't know, then you don't, I don't even know where to start. Like, okay, well, I think I know where I'm starting, which is sitting right here until you make a coherent sentence and form a cohesive side, because I'm not giving up on you. And I know you want to walk away right now. And I'm sitting right here, dude. And I'm just going to listen.
What I love is that your use of two words is lens and frame, because I feel like that is what students in our current moments are sort of needing and looking for. Because I feel like historically they were either given the answer, so here you go, memorize this. And when I ask you what the answer is to whatever question, be it small or existentially big, you tell it back to me and learning has occurred. Or the flip side, where it's just so squishy and mushy, and you know, it's just, well, what do you think? How do you feel? And kids aren't really given a framework to make sense or make meaning of something. So when you give kids lenses, right, it's helping draw their attention to certain things. You're not telling them what to see or how to see it, but you're guiding their attention to certain features in a situation or in a text or in a lab. And it helps, I guess, kind of cut out the noise and have them focus on the signal. But at the same time, you're not telling them what they see. And I feel like when we think about the relationship that kids have with knowledge in our digital world, there's so much knowledge out there that they need lenses and frames to make sense of it and to figure out, what should I pay attention to? And then once they kind of start grasping that, helping them build their own lenses and frames. So I could really see how, if you have a classroom with acceptance, communication, and trust, I could lead them to do that. So could you maybe like provide some instances where students have had those frames and the kind of conversations or the insight that's generated through them?
Yeah. So, one of the big ones is that trust piece and helping them come around to understanding that what's really going on here is you're not trusting each other. So I had a situation, actually very recently, with a couple of learners who were not getting along, but they weren't they weren't having like an actual like visual conflict with each other, but it was like one of those, like, anybody who's been around adolescent ladies knows what they were saying to each other. There was like, oh, the subtext is strong, and the passive aggression in this moment is incredibly like thick, and you could cut it with a knife in here. Oh my gosh, you guys have got to be kinder to one another. But because they're saying all the right words, right, like there isn't anything to really say to them. So a few minutes went by, you know, maybe an hour or something, and I swung back around. The school I'm in is really interesting. One of the things I like about how it works this year is I have this cohort of learners, and we have this like big chunk of time that the three facilitators I work with, we just kind of like manipulate the time in the ways that we think the learners need. So I can walk away for like an hour and come back to the same kiddos, and they're there, or there might be somewhere else, but I can come back to them. Like, there's time for that. I can give them space. Right. And so I sat down with one and then the other, and in both cases, I was like, wow, so you two aren't seeing eye to eye on this at all. And each one of them was like, what are you talking about? I'm like, well, you know, each time so-and-so brings up, you know, well, I'll call them Lori and Karen. Why Karen? Why did I do that to us? That was unkind. I'll call them Lori and Jewel. No, I'm not going to call them Lori and Mary. There we go. Lori and Mary are having this conversation. Oh, anyway. So Lori and Mary, I said, Lori, like Mary's like brought up some pretty good ideas. And you're just like, yeah, no. Like, I didn't say that. I'm like, every time, like, how have you responded? I didn't say anything. I'm like, ha-ha, you said nothing, right? Like, what does that, why is she going to keep bringing up ideas? Why is she going to keep putting things on the table, right? Like, and so I just asked her straight up, why don't you trust her? And she was taken aback. And she wasn't defensive. She's like, why would you say I don't trust her? I'm like, Well, she's putting out ideas that are going to go towards this business that we're starting. And like, she puts ideas on the table. You basically say nothing. And then you go and make alternative designs. Like, it's logo stuff that they were working on. And I was like, so what's up with that? How is that going? And then I went, and she was like, not great. I'm like, so let's just be thoughtful about it, right? Like, I'm not going to tell you what to do. I'm not going to tell you how to fix it, because it's not really a thing that's broken. It's just something that needs to be made aware of, right? And it might be great if I can earn enough trust with you that when the three of us sit together, that, I could give you two a signal and say, we're going to have this conversation right now about how might the two of you start to see more similarities than differences, and how might you be more open with each other about how you're really thinking and feeling, instead of casting furtive glances to your other people in the group to the left and the right, whichever one is on your side, right? And I went and had almost the same conversation with Mary. Really similar. She's a little more, I don't say aggressive, but she's way more demonstrative. She's super excitable and she gets really excited, but she also wears her heart right on the sleeve. So I could watch her energy fade every time Lori didn't say anything, but then started making other designs. Well, at the same time, I said to Mary, like, look at what Lori's done. And she's like, yeah, it's fine. It's a little boring, but I'm like, boring. Have you expressed that? No, I don't want to hurt her feelings. I'm like, that is what you're feeling. Why don't you trust her? Like, why don't you trust her or trust yourself enough to talk about it? Like, and why don't you look at it as, I like the idea, and like we were just saying, and I think it needs some energy, and I'm not sure how to give it energy. Like, I don't know what the solution is. I just am not getting the feeling that I think we want our customers, our clients. What we're doing is we're starting a ski mountain, by the way. I should have started with that.
Yeah.
We're awesome. Rehabilitating a ski mountain. That's what part of the school is doing. I'm like, God, what? Yeah, there's a community ski mountain that hasn't been up and running in over 5 years. And we are getting it back to life.
Awesome.
As a learning experience. Right. And they're working on the logos and they're working on some of the signage and stuff. And that's where all these things are. These two are perfectly fine as friends, but as colleagues, they struggle. And so I just kept asking that. It's a tough question to ask. Why don't you trust them? Right. But it's also something you can ask, and we don't ask it enough.
And it's so, so important. That's a great example that you gave of when students are asked to collaborate. Speaking from your very first point about the transferable skills of this that go around, because in any relationship, professional, even personal relationship, the ability to be able to say, I like this idea. It's not quite there yet. Right. Let's brainstorm together how we can get it to this place. I mean, I just thinking of an example of we just moved back into our house. And so we're trying to do like furniture placement now that my husband and I both work from home more and our kids go to school at home. and so like, where do we put everything and what does one room become? And, all of those things.
Right.
And so it just reminded me of that. If we need to be able to honestly say, I don't like that right there, or I need a different space, or I need something different from this space, or whatever, just that communication, the ability to be able to tell each other how you feel and to be able to problem solve without getting your feelings hurt. I think that's kind of what you illustrated with the concept of trust.
I was going to say it's interesting that you said that they get along well as friends, but then they're put into this different context and their relationship with that concept changes.
Yeah.
That's something we've had a lot of conversations with about as a team, is what happens when a concept goes from one context or situation to another. And by being aware and cognizant of how it changes, that is what can help you transfer. So helping them see, well, why do you have trust as friends but not as colleagues, right? Like, their understanding of that concept of trust is morphing as it goes from the land of friendship to the land of, you know, colleague.
They're like colleagues.
Yeah, yeah, they are, yeah, colleagues. I mean, that's actually, we literally have turned them into a company. Mm-hmm. We just this past week applied a company framework to the whole endeavor. So these 30 learners are now a team of five, an executive team of five, and then these three divisions. I was just thinking here as we were talking about, what if one of our metrics we used for our classrooms was this ACT quotient, for lack of a, I've been messing around in my head with a better way to call it, but what's your acceptance quotient? What's your communication quotient? What's your trust quotient? Like where are your levels at for these three things, right now? And how do you know that? And where is there a deficit, and where is there a surplus, and where is there a balance? And I was, what you were just talking about, Julie, about placing stuff around your room and like, I don't like that there, and I don't like this here, immediately made me think back to those two ladies making making those comments about logos and hearing them. And one of them then saying, oh, she hates everything I do. I was like, I didn't hear her say she hates. Like, who said hate, right? It's the, I can't have this plant in the room. I am so sorry. Whoa, I said I can't have the plant in the room. Mm-hmm. I didn't say I can't have the plant in the room. Why did you ruin my life? That wasn't what I said. But that's what the person heard, mm-hmm. right? And where's that coming from? Like, is that a signifier of not an issue in the relationship, but is that a signifier of a dynamic in a relationship?
Mm-hmm.
Right? Mm-hmm. Is that like, oh, like, I know for me, I apologize constantly because I screw up all the time. Mm-hmm. So I just assume if someone asks me to do something and move something that I place somewhere that I wasn't listening before, I should have taken care of it earlier. Like, I just go immediately to that place, which makes me really difficult to live with. I am not an easy live, not at all. She has 20 plus years of callus built up. It's just like, she's like, yeah, there's lots of things he does that I just don't even notice anymore because, oh my Lord. If she was Catholic, she'd be up for sainthood already. That doesn't even need to pass away. forgo that one. Look, all the miracles, they're right here. But it goes back to this idea of how, you know, is it an issue of communication and where that real issue is. But just, it got me thinking about that idea of these balance points.
Yeah, I think I was just swirling around that you earlier said acceptance and communication lead to trust, almost funnel into. I can't remember exactly what you said. Our listeners can't see us, but you used your hands
funnel shape.
And so could you talk a little bit? I mean, I can see it for sure in my mind, but I just wanted, because you've thought about this a lot longer than I have. Well, how can you articulate it of how acceptance and communication sort of funnel into or lead to trust?
Well, I think it's kind of like, it takes three legs to make a tripod or to make a table stand. Mm. Yeah. Mm. And it takes three wheels to make a thing called a bicycle. But there's always that one tire that you're like, you know, we can make it if we've only got two. Right. Like, I only got two. I know I can get there. Right. We'll just pop a wheelie the whole way. Or that table doesn't have three legs anymore. Just don't push on it too hard. Right. So there is an important leg. There is a more, like, I kind of feel like there is like a really important, like, one leg has precedence over another. And depending on how that table is made, there's one that you can take out or there's one that you can take out and it really like brings the thing towards fragility, right? There's others that it might be okay, but I think of trust as like this, like one leg that is more important than the other two, because I think it's incredibly hard to do either of the other two without trust. But I also think it's impossible to develop trust without those two. right? You have to start with a place of acceptance of reality, of the current situation, of what you're given. I mean, think about in schools how much energy we waste complaining about, well, if only they would. Well, it would be nice if, like, yeah. I've done it. Oh my gosh. Like the hours I could clock, like that, you know, water cooler conversations, mm-hmm. or, you know, teacher room conversations or after school conversations or hallway conversations or whatever. If only they would, if only mm-hmm. they, if only mm-hmm. they, but they aren't.
And it's get back to our original point of yes, but, because that, as Trevor and I go in, as you do too, go into schools yeah. to do professional learning. And so they're like, yes, this sounds great, but.
Right.
Yeah. And then insert, you know, any number of reasons here.
Any number of reasons, because they're not willing yet to accept the thing that you're saying. And if it was just like, hey, let's just pause for a second and let's just accept that the things, let's just pretend. This goes to my hypnosis training too. Let's just pretend that it was real. Like, let's just pretend for a moment that you did think this was the best idea ever. Because that's why we're here, is to tell you the best ideas ever. Why would we waste our time telling you crappy ideas? That would be stupid, right? right? So I'm here to tell you the best ideas. Let's just pretend that you thought it was good. What would that be like? What would that posture be
yeah,
like?
I love
what
it.
What would happen? What would happen with, like, your whole sense of self about this? Well, you're telling me I have to love it? No, I'm telling you to pretend. I'm telling you to lie. You know, like lie to yourself, lie to the people around you, you know, but you're communicating that, right? And if you're making it clear, this is not something I actually believe, but I'm going to play this pretend game of liking this, it can change your whole perception. It can change how you see everything. You know, I wasn't expecting to talk about hypnosis so much, but it's true. It's like I use what I've learned about the subconscious and what I learned through clinical and therapeutic hypnosis. I use it all the time because it does shape how we think about things.
Well, it's interesting. I'm wondering if in just having these little connect the dots in my brain, and maybe it's a unicorn and it's not actually anything that's related, but I was wondering about the idea of acceptance, because it's so related to mindfulness, which is thankfully more in vogue now.
And hopefully it will stay.
Yes. And
hopefully
and
it's not.
I was wondering if, okay, so it's improviser's mindset. My train of thought is like, okay, the world is so complex. It's changing so fast. I mean, we knew that before COVID, and now it's just pronounced even more. And so the idea of improv seems to be a useful skill for everybody, not only skill, but ethos, mindset for everybody yeah. to sort of undertake. You know, just some of the data points Trevor and I look at are about the number of different jobs or this sort of lifelong learning that today's children will have to have. And they're probably going to live to like 120 too. Like that's, it's just, it's also yeah, interesting, that like everything never that's
mind,
happening.
Never mind their life expectancy has gone yeah. up like 30 years.
And know? So the idea of sort of constantly learning and the idea of improv being flexible and flexible thinking and you pointing out that at its core, the first concept that you gave us was acceptance, and just sort of how I'm just wondering if there's like a connection between the way you use the word acceptance and the way mindfulness uses the word acceptance. So just like, you know, it is what it is. I love that book. Wherever you go, there you are.
Right. Well, it is what it is. I think the piece that I add on to it that I don't know that mindfulness is I say you need to accept that which is so that you can then transform it. Because you can't enact any sort of change if you're not willing to accept the thing that's there. I mean, full disclosure, let's get super real here. I'm 35 pounds heavier than I was 3 years ago. I'm not thrilled about it. Like, and I go around grousing about it all the time. Like I am deeply unhappy with myself. Do you know what I've done about it this week? Jack squat. You know what I did about the week before? Nothing. You know why? Because I'm still not accepting it. I'm still in this like mourning of like, well, you know, if I, you know, I could just like, you know, if I just started tomorrow, it'd be okay. No, bull crap. Like it's like we passed that, you know, we've got a long ways to go now, dude. You got some work, and also might need to accept that I'm not going to get back to that place that was before, and need to also accept the fact that maybe before, like when I was like at my lightest, I wasn't actually healthy. Like maybe there was some crap wrong with me, and maybe there was a whole lot else going on in life that wasn't great, but I was like, but I'm healthy. Like I'm in good physical shape. Oh, my personal relationships are not awesome. My professional life is kind of in a weird spot, you know, like maybe it wasn't all, you know, peaches and roses just because I could wear small. But dang, for the fat kid from eighth grade to be wearing a small t-shirt was like the best, right? Like that's where I was at not very long ago. But I have to get to that acceptance place so that I can start to change it. And I don't know that in mindfulness, I feel like in mindfulness, it's less about trying to be an agent of change and more to just be really super aware of everything around you. And you know, I am no Brené Brown. I'm no hey, but the gospel according to Brené says. And I'm like, no, there are people who have written far more and done all sorts of thinking around it far more than I have. And it's you know, there's amazing people like Kate. There's great people doing great work all the time around it. So I can't pretend that I'm an expert in it. I just, that's my kind of common wisdom that I ride. That mindfulness is very close to that meditative Zen place.
I feel like the type of acceptance that you're talking about is admitting to yourself that you currently don't have the solution. Because if you were to have the solution, it wouldn't really be a problem. And when I think about those yes, but conversations, if you aren't accepting of the fact that that issue can be solved, then you are never going to find a solution. So if you yes, but every situation, and you're always looking for that, then if the situation isn't fixed, clearly whatever your immediate environment is, whatever your immediate actions are, aren't fixing it. So if you don't have that yes and situation, or sorry, yes and mindset, then the problem won't get solved. So it's a matter of accepting that currently you, whatever issue you have or problems going on, you can't fix it. You don't have the answer. But unless you are accepting and willing to go looking for those answers, then it won't get solved. And that's why I think some of the most interesting people that I see or talk to in education are people that are looking outside of education for answers to problems in education. Because I think that there is so much complexity in the world, and there's so many people thinking about how to solve things that are related to education, but maybe aren't like in the day-to-day of the instruction and the curriculum. So I think that's why I think it's fascinating to hear people think about, how can mindfulness, what can mindfulness bring to education or design or you know, the improviser's mindset? Because if we are open and accepting of the fact that there are plenty of solutions that exist to problems that maybe aren't in our immediate vision, that can really lead to us being able to solve problems because we are open to the different solutions that maybe we wouldn't have seen otherwise.
Oh, I agree. And I want to yes and that. And I think it would really help us all if we started looking at mindfulness, improviser's mindset, you pick the frameworks that help you. Start looking at them less as another thing that you're doing and start looking at them as the architecture. Like build your learning experiences around them with those in the center, right? Like let them truly be frames. I mean, that's the whole point of a frame. It's like it has structure to it, right? It gives you a place to set things and build off of, right? So if you look at it as, well, now we have to do mindfulness work too. Now I need to improv work too. Well, now when am I going to do a design project? I don't have time for that. Like, you don't need to have time for it. You know, like become a project-based teacher. That's okay. Become a problem-based teacher. That's okay. Like let it be the frame that all the other stuff lives inside. Right? You don't have to keep adding and adding and adding. I was talking with the K-12 art chat crew there, the Grundlers, about critical creativity just the other day. And we were talking about, like, people are always like thinking the only way to integrate art is by doing more. It's like, no, you got to start replacing some of the slough that you got that isn't working. Because if everything you're doing is working, why are you even looking to add new things, right? You know that if you're looking, something isn't cooking, right? You know that you're trying to improve. You're going to have to replace a thing. There is space for artistic expression as a way to demonstrate content learning in every single classroom. And you have to trust that it's going to work out. And you've got to accept that you're going to have to let some things go in order to make that happen. And it shouldn't be that hard to find low-hanging fruit. Like, if it is, well, you're not ready to start adopting new things yet, because you've got to really start doing some work on what's working and what's not working before you start worrying about, like, well, I think I'm going to become this type of a teacher, or I'm going to grouse about this thing I'm being asked to do. You know?
And like, I think that's what drew me so much to Julie's work initially, is it helped me not add a bunch of more stuff onto what I was doing, but to organize and arrange things around these broader concepts, and to be able to reach outside of education and pull things in, like a podcast I was listening to, other nonfiction books I was reading, YouTube videos that I saw.
Yeah.
And it helped me to reorganize and reorient things that I was already doing around these powerful frames and lenses. And I think that going back to what we were saying earlier about the importance of frames and lenses is, like, that's, we need to help students be able to build those frames. And it's not the doing of the thing as much as it is, like you said, I love, like, the architecture underneath, like, what are those deeper concepts and how do they interact with each other? And how can we see that play out in a different context, as opposed to what, you know, facts or bytes of information are you trying to right. take, or what acronyms are you using, or what, you know, worksheets or language are you tending to? It's about looking for those deeper patterns and using those patterns as sort of a jumping off point for another problem.
Right. Yeah. And I mean, I know we're getting towards the end, so this is probably the worst time to raise this, especially as three people of white privilege having this conversation. But it's like, if we start working on looking at things through frames and frameworks, it makes it easier for us to see frames. It also makes it much more likely that we can recognize systemic inequalities and systemic problems and systemic injustices that are, like, permeating society. And we can do so in a way that doesn't have to make a villain out of any current person, unless they are deliberately trying to perpetuate inequity. Most people aren't. They just don't realize that they are, right? They just haven't had that part of them activated. But when they say, I don't see it. Well, you haven't been trained at all to look for structures. You've not been trained. You haven't had any experience of what it's like to go through a learning experience, any experience where there is a conceptual framework, like, guiding all the work that you're doing. Except a lot of folks have, and it's called a church. Like, they exist, but they're not aware that that's what's happening. You were on a team, you were on the, like, you have been in these frameworks, these conceptual frameworks, but you weren't aware of them. So then you don't know how to identify, you know how to see them, you don't know how to look, you don't know how to see the architecture. You're just seeing the cool stuff on the outside. You're just walking into the fourth house, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Like, and you're not looking at me being like, oh,
I love
dude,
that. Yeah.
That foundation was not fixed right.
Yeah.
You know, like, they just wanted to flip this thing, right? Like, you just don't know.
Yeah.
But we can get there.
I love that.
We're starting to.
I think that, you know, what you just said, of course, hits it home really, really well. But what Trevor was saying earlier, I felt the word that was coming to my mind, or the term that was coming to my mind, was intellectual humility. Where you know, you first have to admit that, you know, you first have to accept that you don't know everything. And that your perspective is indeed a perspective, and that you don't hold all the pieces to the puzzle of life on Earth. And so I think that, you know, seems to me to be wrapped up in that word acceptance. And just if you don't start there, then it gets really hard to, as Trevor was saying, just to improvise or to solve complex problems. And
right.
I think this is really nice. Everything that you were saying, just about how do we remain flexible and nimble? I mean, that's something that we promote a lot. There's so many similarities to what you're saying and what we're promoting at the core. In fact, I don't think you even know this, but you keep saying ACT. We have the ACT model for transfer. The T is transfer for us.
Well, there it is.
Yeah,
right. We love a good. Now, do you end it with the cheesy line? If you're doing A, C, and T, you're having fun, and that's a fact? Because that's how I always end my workshops.
Well, we'll have to workshop on those.
No, I think it's great. It's and what you guys are doing, it's exceptional, it's remarkable, and I love being around your brains. So thank you for letting me come and like partake in that which the Angela Stockman is already so familiar with, right? Like, I'm just like, good company of good thinkers.
Good humans.
I appreciate you. You could say that it's been a podcast that's been high on acceptance, communication, and trust, which is what led to this great dialogue.
where can you, did a quick little plug for your books in the beginning, but where can people find more about you? Is there like a one-stop shop, website, or?
There is a one-stop shop, danrider207.com. Why 207? Because that's Maine's only area code. That's right. We still don't have enough people to get two area codes. Awesome.
Ryder 207, RYDER, correct?
That's right, just like the truck.
All right, beautiful.
But yes, find me there and find me on social, and I'm easy to find. I'm not hiding.
Awesome.
Thanks so much.
Thanks for tuning in to this episode of Conceptually Speaking. We hope you enjoyed the conversation and are coming away with a stronger grasp of the concepts and mental models that help us understand our world. If you like this podcast, feel free to like, comment, or subscribe on your favorite platform. If you want to learn more or get involved, check out our website at edtosavetheworld.com and join our Facebook group, Learning the Transverse.